Blackstone Audiobooks presents Jean-Paul Sartre in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. Introduction. Jean-Paul Sartre was the most popular philosopher in history during his lifetime. His work was known to students, intellectuals, revolutionaries, and even the general reading public the world over. Two main reasons account for this unprecedented popularity, neither of which has to do with Sartre's abilities as a philosopher. First, he became the spokesman for existentialism at the opportune moment, when this philosophy filled the spiritual gap left amidst the ruins of Europe in the aftermath of World War II. And second, his later adoption of a revolutionary stance against authority struck a chord in the era of Che Guevara, worldwide student unrest, and sentimental sympathy for the Cultural Revolution in Communist China. Where politics was concerned, Sartre wrote about almost everything. Alas, events proved him wrong about almost everything. Sartre's earlier philosophy is another matter. He may not have been the first existentialist, but he was the first publicly to accept this label. He was also one of its most able exponents. Sartre's ability to develop philosophical ideas and their implications remained unrivalled in the 20th century. But this was done with imaginative brilliance rather than analytic rigour. As a result, he was dismissed with contempt by many orthodox thinkers who claimed that neither he nor existentialism had anything to do with real philosophy. Existentialism was the philosophy that showed the ultimate freedom of the individual, succinctly encapsulated by the nightclub singer Juliette Gréco, "Whatever you do, you become." Existentialism could be as shallow as this, and, in the hands of Sartre, as profound as any contemporary philosophy. It was the exciting and personally involving philosophy of action, or, to its critics, the ultimate theory of introspection, bordering on solipsism, the belief that only I exist. Yet all are agreed that in Sartre's hands existentialism became a revolt against the European bourgeois values that lay in ruins after World War II. The bourgeoisie, essentially the middle class, came to stand for all that existentialism was not. It was impossible to be an existentialist and a bourgeois. Sartre's life and works. Jean-Paul Sartre was born a bourgeois. His father was a young naval officer who died of a fever in 1906 when Sartre was 1 year old. Sartre was to describe this as the greatest event of my life. Had he lived, my father would have lain down on top of me and squashed me. Having been denied this Oedipal fantasy, Sartre claimed that he grew up with no sense of filial obedience, no superego, no aggressivity. He had no interest in authority, nor any wish to exercise power over others. So it comes as something of a surprise that this saintly childhood gave rise to an undying hatred for the bourgeoisie, and any middle-class habits or values associated with this worthy section of the community, a lifelong need to combat any sort of authority, and a desire to establish psychological dominance over all who came into close contact with him. Sartre was to examine, with the brilliance of genius, the intricate workings of his mind, but more obvious points often eluded him. Sartre's mother, Anne-Marie, along with her saintly infant, returned home to live on the outskirts of Paris with her father, Karl Schweitzer, uncle of the African missionary Albert Schweitzer. Grand-père Schweitzer was a typical French patriarchal figure of the period. He dressed in elegant suits and a Panama hat. His word was law in the otherwise entirely female household, and he was constantly unfaithful to his wife. In his autobiography, Les Mots, Words, Sartre remembered him as a handsome man with a flowing white beard who was always waiting for the next opportunity to show off. He looked so much like God the Father that he was sometimes taken for him. Here, surely, was a superego straight out of central casting. But Sartre refused to acknowledge his grandfather in this vacant psychological role. Young Jean-Paul and his mother were treated like the children of the household, and Sartre came to regard Anne-Marie more as a close sister than as a mother. Unlike the father figure that he claimed he didn't need, This mother-sister figure was to become an essential requirement for the rest of his life. Judging from all descriptions, including his own, Sartre appears to have had a blissfully happy childhood. Surrounded by doting females, young Jean-Paul's ego quickly expanded to make up for its lack of a superior element. As if sanctity were not enough, the child saint now declared to himself, "I am a genius." No one contradicted him. Even grandfather swept him into his arms and called him "my little treasure." With characteristic obtuseness, Sartre was later to declare, "I hate my childhood and everything that survives from it." Unlike other conceited little brats who come to the conclusion that they are a genius, Sartre had the imagination, endurance, and exceptional mind necessary to fulfill this self-appointed role. Young Sartre was soon filling exercise book after exercise book with long tales of knightly adventure and heroism. It was now that Sartre suffered from the accident that was to mark his appearance for life. While on a seaside vacation, he caught a cold. In those days, the medical profession had a respectability that far exceeded its actual ability, and the young boy's cold was allowed to develop disastrous complications. As a result, Sartre suffered from leukoma of his right eye, which led to strabismus and a partial loss of vision. In brutal, unmedical language, he now had a grotesque squint, with one all but blind eye left in a permanent oblique stare. But solipsism can soon overcome even such blemishes, and Jean-Paul's childish idyll continued. Then something really awful happened. His mother had the thoughtless effrontery to marry again. Jean-Paul was horrified. He was no longer the centre of Anne-Marie's attention, and the new Madame Moncy moved to faraway La Rochelle with her usurper husband, Joseph. At the age of 12, the awkward, wall-eyed child travelled to the port of La Rochelle to live with his mother and Joseph Moncy. In Sartre's autobiography, written in his 50s, his 43-year-old stepfather is remembered with a vividness that speaks of deep feeling. "My mother did not marry my stepfather for love. He was not very pleasant, a tall, thin man with a black moustache, uneven complexion, very large nose." The authoritarian and utterly bourgeois Monsieur Moncy was ideally cast for the role of the wicked stepfather. He was rich, lived in an opulent mansion, and was an eminent citizen in a provincial city of impeccable provincial complacency. Joseph Moncy was president of the local Delaunay-Belleville shipyards. He ran his business efficiently, in old-fashioned capitalist style. Any threat of a strike was preempted with a lockout until hunger resolved the issue. Every evening after work he would call his stepson into the glittering front salon, where he would give him additional lessons in geometry and algebra. In keeping with his general demeanour, Monsieur Moncy preferred the orthodox approach to teaching. Persistent failure to arrive at the correct answer would result in a slap. Meanwhile, the little prig in his smart Parisian knickerbockers was greeted with whistles of derision by his less fashionable fellow pupils at the lycée. This baptism of fire induced self-sufficiency and introversion. Sartre was not one to be cowed by bullies. His undefeated egoism developed into a full independence of mind. The more perceptive among his classmates recognized that the short, puny dandy, who had a face like a frog, possessed an exceptional mind, despite the fact that he didn't excel in exams. Possibly as a direct result of his stepfather's insistent tutoring, France's best mind of his generation usually settled about a third of the way down from the top of his class. Sartre occupied the traditional double role of resident genius and class scapegoat. He was the unpleasant, spotty little character in glasses who knew everything, and made sure everyone knew this. But he had also developed the revealing habit of making blunders. One anecdote will suffice. Characteristically, the source is Sartre himself, 40 years later. Like all the other boys at the lycée, Sartre would fantasize about the women in the port's red light district. His exceptional imagination had soon outclassed the rather paltry exploits of his teenage classmates. "I told them that there was this woman with whom I went to the hotel, that I met her in the afternoon, and that we did what they said they did with their whores. I even asked my mother's maid to write me a letter. Dearest Jean-Paul. They guessed my trick. I confessed, and became the laughing stock of the class. These were tough times. World War I had broken out, and many of Sartre's fellow pupils were living alone with their mothers, their fathers having been called to the front. The carnage in the trenches took its toll, and his bereaved classmates took out their grief-fueled aggression on anyone perceived to be in a position of weakness. Sartre developed a mental toughness as well as a certain ambivalence. He refused to conform just to join a gang of thoughtless idiots, but he longed to be accepted. He wanted to be popular, but on his own terms. This ambivalence, too, would remain lifelong. But in the privacy of his room, the little frog face with the wall eye would become a prince. Seated at his desk, the boy who kept consoling himself, "I am a genius," was already starting on the impossible task of becoming one. The exercise books, filled with tales of romantic chivalry, had given way to autobiographical texts, and now he began to write entire novels. By the age of 14 he had completed his second novel, Getz von Berlichingen, about a medieval German tyrant. This reaches its climax when the tyrant's subjects rise up against him, destroying the local mills and weaving shops, some of which bear more than a passing resemblance to shipyards. The tyrant is finally put to death in ingenious and excruciating fashion. His head is shoved through a hole in a steeple clock so that it emerges at the Roman numeral 12. The tyrant sweats out his last moments of life in increasing anguish as the arm of the clock rises second by second toward the point where it will decapitate him at noon. This combination of anguish, violence, and mortal extremity were to be hallmarks of the mature writer, in whose works they retain all the immediacy of adolescent angst. The intense teenage growing pains that Sartre now experienced were to leave an indelible mark. At this age, such feelings are often inextricably mixed with awakening philosophical questioning. Part of Sartre's genius was his ability to retain this combination and the emotional-intellectual force it generates in a young mind growing into awareness and bewilderment. In 1919, Sartre began stealing money from his mother's purse. This he used to curry favour with his classmates, buying them exotic cream cakes and rum barbars at a smart local café. Sartre's joy at his popularity, the sickly taste of the cakes, is undermined by guilt and uncertainty, an underlying sourness. Another poignant emotional combination that was to become a recurrent theme, sticky sweet and nauseous. Inevitably, Sartre's ruse was unmasked, involving him in further ridicule from his ungrateful school pals and the usual parental rumpus. Some sort of climax was reached, and Sartre volunteered to return to Paris, preferring to live under the iron rule of God the grandfather rather than that of Mammon the cliché stepfather. Sartre the rebel was now learning to choose where to rebel, which circumstances were best suited to his particular form of rebellion, useful first steps in what was to turn into a lifelong campaign. At 15, Sartre became a weekly boarder at the prestigious Lycée Henri IV. He began reading voraciously, absorbing a huge range of literature, much of it beyond his emotional or intellectual comprehension. Meanwhile, his writing branched out into notebooks of aphorisms and philosophical speculation. The standard of these pensées can be judged from his definition of love. Desire consists of treating a woman as a means, not an end. Love consists of treating a woman as an end, not a means. As with so much of this kind of quintessentially French wisdom, his remarks teetered between the spuriously epigrammatic and genuine insight. His philosophy teacher remarked perceptively of his excessive elaboration of insufficiently clarified ideas, which remains to this day the orthodox Anglo-American position on Sartre's entire philosophy. Sartre passed his baccalaureate, the tough national school graduation exam, and secured a place at the École Normale Supérieure. Contrary to its name, there is nothing normal whatsoever about this school, which skims the cream of France's university students. A selection of Sartre's contemporaries here gives an indication of the standard. These included such future stars as the philosophers Raymond Aron and Maurice Merleau-Ponty, the leading anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, the finest if most hysterical theologian-philosopher of her time, Simone Weil, the future great director of the École itself, Jean Hippolyte, and the writer-philosopher Simone de Beauvoir. Sartre thrived in this hot-house atmosphere. According to his friends, his ugliness vanished the moment he spoke. The spotty little student in glasses shone at the café tables of the left bank. Except when he's asleep, he thinks all the time. He was the best and most generous companion imaginable. Underneath the cynicism and self-disgust which he willingly displayed, his secret was indubitably a great softness which he managed neither to acknowledge nor to disclaim. According to Sartre himself, I was a thousand Socrates. Emerging from his shell, he developed a prodigious thirst for beer and discovered to his delight that young women, bamboozled by his intellect, were capable of finding his ugliness attractive. His thirst for sexual conquests was soon second only to his thirst for beer. But neither of these could match his appetite for books, ideas, knowledge. He read everything. Everything, it appears, except what he was required to read for his courses. To the astonishment of everyone, especially himself, Sartre failed his first attempt at the agrégation, graduation exam. As a result, during the following year, his brilliance became a little more directional. Despite his failure, Sartre remained the star pupil. By now he had acquired the scruffiness encouraged by student life in Paris, where running water was a rarity. Sartre soon dispensed with such bourgeois customs as bathing, and took up smoking a pipe, whose aroma was presumably strong enough to disguise any other emanating from a nearby source. He would be seen at cafés in the Latin Quarter engaged in intense intellectual discussion with his circle of cronies, which included Aron and, briefly, Merleau-Ponty. Philosophy was the usual topic of conversation. There was no point in joining this table unless you had something particularly intelligent to say, and could say it with intellectual verve. One day the group was joined by a tall, serious-minded 21-year-old girl who was interested in philosophy. Her name was Simone de Beauvoir, and she quickly demonstrated that she could hold her own in their philosophical discussions. Simone de Beauvoir was of impeccable bourgeois background, much like Sartre. She had received an upper-class convent education, which she was now earnestly rebelling against. She quickly acquired the nickname The Beaver, a symbol of hard work and energy, according to the member of the group who christened her. Any salacious American associations with this name would have been viewed dimly, even by Sartre's determinedly unbourgeois group, though the men were not above similar Rabelaisian witticisms when they were having a few beers on their own. Charming, pretty, dresses horribly, she was wearing a hideous little hat, was how the debonair 24-year-old Sartre assessed de Beauvoir. It was love at first sight, according to de Beauvoir. Either way, Sartre and de Beauvoir became lovers. Sartre soon assumed the additional roles of mentor, exposer of bourgeois behaviour, and clothes adviser. "From now on, I'm going to take you under my wing," he told her. It didn't quite work out that way. Despite her brilliance, he demolished her in argument. But the Beaver responded with honest and penetrating critiques of Sartre's ideas. For the first time in his life, he'd met his match. The Beaver's critical pronouncements were received like holy writ. But it went deeper than this. Here was the double which de Beauvoir had fantasized about during the long, lonely years of her adolescence. And Sartre, far from becoming her fashion adviser, soon found himself being mothered. Suggestions of baths, change of shirt, pimple cream, and so forth. De Beauvoir may have found her psychological double, but Sartre had also found someone who had slipped into the vacant role of sister-mother. These roles were embryonic and largely unconscious to begin with, but right from the start it was obvious that this was no casual passing relationship. There could be no question of them entering into any permanent relationship. That would have been bourgeois. Even the idea of regarding themselves as a couple was philosophically unthinkable. Bourgeois domesticity, cohabitation, fiancé, conventional affection, such dangerous elements had to be avoided at all cost. No, theirs would be an open relationship, they decided, no strings attached. The student lovers studied, ate at cheap left-bank bistros, made love, discussed ideas in the cafes, in bed, walking in the Jardin de Luxembourg, and studied and read, and studied and read and explained, and studied again during the hot summer weeks, and then they took their agrégation. When the results of the philosophy exam were posted, Sartre was first, de Beauvoir second. The cream of France's coming intellectual generation left trailing in their wake. Cozy university days over, the student lovers now had to face the real world. Teaching for de Beauvoir, military service for Sartre. In true intellectual fashion, they decided to define their relationship. Sartre stated his position. The abiding passion of his life was writing. All else would always remain secondary. Apart from writing, he believed in travel, polygamy, and transparency. After military service, he had plans to become a lecturer in Japan. He wanted to preserve their special relationship, but also enjoyed the company of other women. He refused to surrender his principle of personal liberty, therefore all notion of bourgeois fidelity was out. On the other hand, he did recognize that theirs was a special relationship. They would therefore agree to a 2-year lease. They would have 2 years of intimacy together, and then they would separate for 2 or 3 years. They would remain extremely close, but their relationship wouldn't grow stale and develop into a habit like any bourgeois relationship. The 2-year lease would ensure this. Having defined their relationship in curiously bourgeois and capitalist terms, Sartre proceeded to elaborate on this in a more emphatic philosophical manner, drawing on Kant's distinction between necessary and contingent truths. For Kant, a necessary truth was one whose denial involved a self-contradiction. For example, philosophers seek the truth. Truth-seeking is part of the definition of a philosopher, so to deny this statement involves a self-contradiction. On the other hand, to deny the statement, philosophers often talk twaddle, does not involve a self-contradiction. The statement is not necessarily true or untrue in any logical sense. Unless, that is, your definition of a philosopher includes the inability to talk twaddle. The truth of the second statement is thus contingent. Sartre proposed that throughout their 2-year lease and in the period after it, his relationship with the beaver would be necessary. Any other affairs he or she might embark upon would be considered contingent. Obtuse, unphilosophical thinkers may be forgiven for jumping to the wrong conclusion here. What did Sartre really mean? When he had a contingent relationship, it was not necessary, even to tell her about it? On the contrary, this was where the third element of Sartre's travel, polygamy, transparency, life plan came into play. He wished for his relationship with de Beauvoir to be utterly clear and truthful. They would tell each other everything, and have no secrets. Viewed from a lifetime away, it is difficult for us to appreciate the novelty and daring of this relationship. Paris may have been the traditional city of lovers, but France in the 1920s remained in the stranglehold of bourgeois morality, as indeed did most civilized parts of the world, apart from Utah. The nuclear family was the foundation of conventional morality. Respectability was the order of the day, and hypocrisy was the order of the night. People broke the rules, but not publicly. Sartre and de Beauvoir came out of the closet. This was an audacious thing to do in France at the time, and their example was later to become an inspiration to intellectuals around the world. Here was an attempt to live an honest and open relationship in which both partners were independent and free. If relationships were to be rational, this surely was the way they should be. Whether or not even this relationship managed to achieve rationality is another matter, which will be discussed at a consequent stage of its development. Suffice to say that for the time being it did, or at least appeared to do so. In the immortal words of the man who so heroically defined the new relationship between thinking men and thinking women, The beaver accepted this freedom and kept it. Sartre set off for his 18-month military service, and de Beauvoir began teaching psychology at a girls' school in the Paris suburbs. Sartre must have been the worst soldier since Buster Keaton, but he eventually managed to escape into a meteorological unit, where his friend Aron was the instructor. Together they blew up weather balloons and observed them drift away across the Loire Valley. Off-duty he read voraciously, again everything from philosophy to detective mags. In between times he would concentrate his exceptional mental powers and think, usually straight onto the page. The beaver received and sent voluminous, almost daily letters in which they discussed the workings of their minds, and on the weekends they would meet. Sartre's invariable greeting, "I've thought up a new theory." In fact, he was doing very much the opposite, destroying one theory after another. Descartes was wrong. Kant was inadequate. Hegel was bourgeois. Not one of the traditional philosophies was adequate to life as it was lived in the 20th century. Intense introspection had made Sartre aware of his psychological topography, and he became fascinated by Freud. But in the end, Freud, too, was not up to scratch. Psychoanalysis denied the autonomy of the mind. As the intellectual edifices fell one by one, all that was left was the freedom of the individual. The lecturer's job in Japan fell through, so after the army, Sartre took up a teaching post at Le Havre, another provincial port city. The brilliant young student from Paris was suitably unconventional, enough to become popular with his students, but not enough to get himself the sack. One day, during the holidays, he was sitting drinking apricot cocktails with the beaver and Aron at a café in Montparnasse. Sartre was expressing his dissatisfaction with philosophy. It never came to grips with real life. Aron disagreed with him. Hadn't he heard of the German philosopher Husserl and phenomenology? "You see, mon petit camarade, if you're a phenomenologist, you can talk about this drink, and that's philosophy." Sartre listened, spellbound. Here at last was the philosophy he had been looking for, a philosophy of the individual and his involvement in the world. Sartre applied for a grant to study Husserl, and in 1933 set off to spend a year at the French Institute in Berlin. The overall term for the philosophy that Sartre had chosen to study was existentialism. This was originated by the 19th-century Danish philosopher and religious thinker Søren Kierkegaard. He believed that the only basis for a meaningful philosophy was the existing individual. Philosophy had nothing to do with detached contemplation of the world and the rational attempt to decipher the truth. For Kierkegaard, truth and experience were inextricably intertwined. We had to abandon the idea that philosophy was some kind of exact science. Previously, philosophic certainty had been based upon epistemology, which studies the grounds upon which we base our knowledge. But Kierkegaard insisted that being human meant more than thinking. We are not just reasoning minds with a body attached. Human beings are not simply, or even primarily, knowers. They also desire, choose, act, suffer, and experience a wide range of emotions which color their experience. These, too, are all an integral part of experience. They are all involved in what it means to be human. This was what real philosophy should be about, according to Kierkegaard. It should be existence philosophy, i.e., existentialism, a word he coined. Kierkegaard's philosophy stressed the irrational element in human existence, thus turning all previous philosophy on its head. Typically, he said, "The first thing to understand is that we do not understand." For him, subjectivity was truth, and truth thus became subjective. Philosophy should not aim to explain or illuminate the darkness of the world. It should aim to illuminate existence itself. We should aspire to become this life in its complete consciousness of itself. Here the first real difficulties of existentialism began to appear. In trying to explain itself, it became like a snake swallowing its tail. Having disavowed the rigidities of conceptual thought and argument, this left its own concepts and arguments blurred and muddied. To the rationalists, this rendered such arguments ultimately meaningless. But Kierkegaard remained undaunted by such attacks. He continued to maintain that instead of dealing in abstract principles, we should concentrate upon the particularity of experience and its essentially individual nature. Only in this way do we come to realize our utter freedom. True, when we experience this sentiment of the possible, it may overwhelm us with a sense of dread or angst. Yet this very angst is identical with the realization of our ultimate freedom to choose our life. The German philosopher Edmund Husserl was born in 1859, 4 years after the death of Kierkegaard. His work is now regarded as a development of the existentialist tradition, though he was far from being a direct follower of Kierkegaard, and in fact disagreed with him on several fundamental points. Unlike Kierkegaard, Husserl retained a certain belief in traditional philosophy, at least in its aims. Indeed, his starting point was an attempt to overcome the division between the two main strands of contemporary philosophy, namely rationalism and empiricism. The rationalist element was epitomized by its originator, the 16th-century Frenchman René Descartes. He based his systematic rational view of the world upon one bedrock certainty, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. The empiricist argument was most forcibly put by the 18th-century Scotsman David Hume, who maintained that we can know nothing for certain apart from what we actually experience. Even such things as causality can never be certain, for we never actually experience one thing causing another, simply a succession of events. Husserl tried to resolve this dichotomy by seeking some fundamental level which underlay both points of view. He declared that only by analyzing the immediate experience that precedes systematic thought can we discover the philosophical ground upon which such things as logic and mathematics, i.e., the domain of reason, are based. We must return to the immediacy of reality as it presents itself to our experience. This could be done only by analyzing the raw material of consciousness prior to the presuppositions or theories that we so habitually impose upon it. In other words, we must deal with the basic phenomena of our experience. To this activity, Husserl gave the name phenomenology. In this way, Husserl sought to turn philosophy into an exact science. Mental acts could be described in a way that freed them from our prejudices about the objective nature of the world. They could also be analyzed in such a way as to free them from assumptions about their own nature. Thus, phenomenology would require a scrupulous and scientific examination of one's consciousness as well as of one's intellectual processes, so that one could determine the ultimate phenomena of experience and experience it as it is. Now Sartre could see what Aron meant when he said that even talking about a glass of apricot cocktail could be philosophy. By examining the sticky, bilious phenomena that constituted this encounter, we could come to philosophical conclusions about the nature of experience, our being and the world, and thus existence itself. This was existentialism. "May you live in interesting times," says the old Chinese curse. Berlin in 1933 was about as interesting as it gets. Before Sartre's arrival in September, Hitler had won election as Chancellor of Germany, and during the ensuing year he set about consolidating his power, marching his stormtroopers through the streets with banners and flares, holding public book burnings, dissolving the trade unions, purging the civil service and academia of Jews. Here was ideal schooling for someone who was later to set himself up as one of the leading political theorists of our time. Or so one might think. But Sartre had something far more interesting to study: his own consciousness. Judging from most reports, Sartre spent his year in Berlin in a kind of solipsistic daze, straining to discern the pure, untrammelled phenomena of his experience. Meanwhile, the cabarets of Isherwood and Sally Bowles were being smashed to smithereens. This lack of concern for the phenomena of reality, what actually went on out there and how things worked in practice rather than theory, was to become a persistent feature of Sartre's philosophical activity. With regard to the epistemology and phenomenology of existentialism, this flaw remained implicit. But it was to become increasingly obvious as he developed a more political philosophy, In 1934, Sartre returned to teach at Le Havre. Here he began to keep a notebook of his phenomenological quest. De Beauvoir persuaded him to turn this into a novel. Eventually this would be called La Nausée, Nausea. It is about a quasi-autobiographical character called Roquentin and his aimless life in provincial Bouville, Mud Town. Precious little happens, but this is perhaps the greatest portrayal of the existential condition ever written. It is a deeply involving work, but it is also something more, that rarest entity, a philosophical novel that is neither abstract nor didactic. In a profound sense, this is what existentialism is. Sartre is nothing if not ambitious here. He poses the fundamental question, what am I? But he refuses to answer this in any intellectual way. For him the answer lies in describing and brilliantly evoking the very feel of existence. Sartre's phenomenological quest had now led him to expand his notion of contingency. Hume had shown that we experience no such thing as causality, going on to expand his argument. Necessity is something that exists in the mind, not in objects. In other words, we impose it on reality. It is an assumption, a prejudice, which may have proved vital to our evolution, but this does not mean it exists in reality. Hume saw all this intellectually. Sartre's brilliance was to realize the truth of this in experience, i.e. existentially. Everything was contingent. Indeed, our entire existence was permeated with contingency. Looked at in this way, the familiar skin of cause and effect, necessity and so forth, which cover the world, simply melts away. Take, for example, what happens when we look in the mirror. To begin with, we see something familiar. But the longer and more profoundly we scrutinize what we see, the more unfamiliar it becomes. In the same way, this unfamiliarity can extend to our entire existence. We thus exist free from all necessity, all certainty. But as Kierkegaard had shown, this realization of the world's strangeness and contingency, and our consequent freedom in it, brings anguish, angst, dread. For Sartre, Roquentin, this manifests itself as nausea, which is likened to the taste of oneself, the very flavour of existence. This phenomenological quest reaches its climax in a celebrated passage where Roquentin confronts and experiences the root of a chestnut tree. In an even more profound way than one's face loses its familiarity in the mirror, for Roquentin the particularity of the chestnut tree becomes utterly alien, and yet absorbing. It no longer had the inoffensiveness of an abstract category. It was the glue of actuality. This root was moulded in existence. The diversity of things, their individuality was only an illusion, a veneer. This veneer had melted, given way to moist solidity, monstrous and chaotic, nude, fearfully and obscenely nude. Ultimately, reality was viscous and obscene. During this experience, Roquentin had been nothing but awareness, and concomitant with this awareness came the realization of the utter absurdity of everything. But once again, this was no intellectual realization. This absurdity was neither a mental idea nor a spoken word, but this long snake rotting at my feet, this wooden snake, i.e. the chestnut root. I realized that I'd found the key to existence, the key to my nausea, to my whole life. I'd experienced the absolute or the absurd. Confronting this large bulbous paw, the root, neither ignorance nor knowledge mattered. The world of explanations and reasons is not that of existence. As a result of this, Sartre understood, man is what he is in the present tense, and he's only there. This had important implications for those who sought meaning in their existence. One cannot put life into perspective while living it. It steals up on you from behind, and you find yourself inside it. Sartre wrote several drafts of La Nausée, and between times wrote a series of short stories. These are less profoundly philosophical, but have a distinctly existential feel to them. In contrast to the novel, they depict various attempts to escape responsibility for one's own existence. The best of these is The Wall, where a man facing death by execution tries to imagine an existence he might have lived rather than facing up to the reality of his actual existence. Industrious as ever, Sartre also wrote directly philosophical works, in which he attempted to apply Husserl's phenomenological methods to an analysis of the emotions and the imagination. In Sketch for a Theory of the Emotions, the first inadequacies of the phenomenological approach become apparent. The emotions are viewed as an evasion of the phenomenological transparency that confronts existence naked. They create a magical world of self-delusion. In seeking a theory of the emotions, Sartre avoids a psychology of the emotions. Psychology is viewed as subordinate to philosophy, rather than as an integral part of the individual. We may achieve phenomenological transparency by using our reason rather than our emotions, but its object is hardly a reasonable state. Sartre's nothing but awareness may have the intellect in abeyance, but the vision of viscous, obscene, nude reality is charged with emotion. Likewise, the consequent brave attempt to take responsibility for our own existence and act accordingly can never totally elude psychological or emotional content. It may be salutary to try to act as if we are free of our psychology, but we can never completely achieve that freedom. Yet Sartre's insistence that we must never hide behind such things is undeniably a brave prescription for a philosophy of action. By now, de Beauvoir had a teaching post at nearby Rouen, and they would meet on the weekends. They also continued to correspond at length during the week. As they had intended at the outset, their relationship remained totally open. There were no secrets whatsoever between them. Yet here again this utter transparency would never be free of psychological undertones. Voyeurism and other murky elements soon became apparent. Apart from its transparency, the necessary relationship was not flourishing. Sartre and de Beauvoir no longer had sex, and the 30-year-old Sartre was developing an appetite for young girls. De Beauvoir was, of course, aware of this. He told her absolutely everything, in graphic detail, which seems to have appealed to the lesbian element in de Beauvoir. Possibly to ensure that she remained in control of the situation, de Beauvoir introduced Sartre to one of her 17-year-old students, but only after she, too, had enjoyed a brief fling with her. Wanda was a waif-like half-Russian who had long blonde hair and an anarchic temperament. Read Spinoza, Barefoot in Winter, etc. Later, Sartre would move on to Wanda's younger sister, Olga. Throughout, Sartre and de Beauvoir retained the exemplary transparency between themselves, but where the others were concerned, a web of deceit to match any bourgeois provincial hypocrisy was soon being spun. Sartre's other attempt at utter transparency was also not quite what it seemed. Years before even such accredited pioneers as Aldous Huxley, Sartre began experimenting with mescaline. It was under the hallucinogenic effects of this drug that he saw the vision of the chestnut tree root that he described in La Noce. Whether it was mescaline or his own psychology that caused him to see ultimate reality as viscous and obscene is difficult to tell, and in a way irrelevant. La Noce is presented as a work of fiction, and Sartre's brilliant rendition of his vision is a consummate metaphor for phenomenological transparency. Though this was not a first. Here literature was way behind art. A quarter of a century earlier, a similarly brilliant metaphorical deconstruction of our suppositions about reality had been achieved by the Cubists. In 1937, Sartre managed to secure a teaching post in Paris and was able to return to his beloved Left Bank. Once again, he could write in the cafés. This was not an affectation. The Left Bank had been the thriving Latin Quarter, student district of Paris, since well before the time of the poet François Villon, in the 15th century. Many of the houses were centuries old and lacked even basic facilities, such as stoves, for heating or cooking, and reliable plumbing. The occupants of such accommodations spent much of their time in the countless cafés and cheap restaurants that had sprung up to remedy this domestic oversight. In April 1938, La Noce was published, followed a few months later by a collection of Sartre's short stories entitled Le Mur, The Wall. Both were received with critical acclaim, establishing Sartre as the coming left-bank literary figure. In 1939, his Sketch for a Theory of the Emotions was published to somewhat less acclaim, but it nonetheless added to his intellectual street cred. Sartre was on the brink of fame, but Europe seemed to be on the brink of war. Sartre, however, had spent a year in Berlin and knew the reality behind Hitler's aggression. "I know the state of mind of the German people. Hitler couldn't possibly dream of going to war," he assured his friends. "He's definitely bluffing." Next day, Hitler invaded Poland, and the French army was mobilized. Within 24 hours, Europe was at war, and Sartre was in uniform. "The war divided my life in two," Sartre wrote later. He was to emerge from this experience completely transformed, in all but the acumen of his political judgment. Sartre was posted to a meteorological unit at the Eastern Front, overlooking the Rhine Valley. The Germans could never attack here. France's eastern border with Germany was protected by the impregnable Maginot Line, the last word in modern defence. This consisted of a linear fortress of concrete bunkers and tunnels, with modern gun emplacements stretching from Belgium to Switzerland. But the French army was not entirely modernized. One of the essential modes of communication on this front remained the carrier pigeon, and the French army reserves consisted of not a few men of the caliber of Private Sartre. Apart from the distraction of sending up a couple of weather balloons each day, Sartre was utterly committed to his work. Unfortunately, this had nothing to do with the army's work. Sartre was well into the first draft of his next novel, and was busy studying Heidegger with a view to completing a really big book on philosophy. The sight of a private reading a book of impenetrable German metaphysics, which even to Germans reads like a code, doesn't seem to have bothered Sartre's patriotic colleagues, or even come to the notice of his officers. Sartre's existentialist ideas were developing fast. In light of our contingency, and thus the absurdity of our existence, we must take complete responsibility for our lives, he explained in his almost daily, pages-long letters to the Beaver. We have no right to bemoan our fate. Each individual wills his own destiny. He wills his character, and even the circumstances under which this character acts. Taken to its logical conclusion, this has some peculiar implications. But Sartre was never one to shirk such difficulties. Yes, this did mean that he, as an individual, was responsible for everything, he explained to the Beaver, which meant he was even responsible for World War II. And he must be willing to accept this responsibility and act accordingly. As he later put it, "This is my war. It is in my image, and I deserve it. Everything happens as if I carried the entire responsibility for this war, so I am this war." This seemingly ludicrous position is in fact far more defensible than many seemingly more plausible philosophical positions. One has only to think of nihilism, or Wittgenstein's claim that all philosophy was just a misunderstanding due to linguistic errors. As we have seen, Sartre's existentialism has its roots in both Hume's empiricism and Descartes' rationalism. Taken to their extremes, both of these veer toward lonely solipsism. Hume, we do not actually experience the individual existence of others. Descartes, if everything except, I think, therefore I am, is uncertain, then the existence of others must also fall into this category. Sartre merely grasps the bull by the horns. He shows the implications of both Descartes and Hume. It may go against all common sense, like most philosophy and much of modern science. But if we are true to our own consciousness, and fillet out all accepted prejudices and assumptions, Sartre's is a defensible position. It is also a brave one, filled with an almost Nietzschean fortitude and optimism. This is my lot. I will make the best of it. If I am free to change my life, I must be responsible for my life. We may draw the line at the multiple sclerosis sufferer, or the snatched hostage forced to live chained in a dungeon, but something akin to Sartre's existential attitude informs both Stephen Hawking and several of those who survived as Beirut hostages. Such people accept what is determined in their fate, and yet overcome this with their remaining freedom. They do, in one sense, take responsibility for their entire life. Traditional philosophers object to Sartre's position by insisting that philosophy should describe what is, not what ought to be, no matter how morally laudable this may be. But existentialism insists upon plunging philosophy into action, so it's not surprising that it should at least partly appear to be a strategy for living. Admittedly, this comes close to being morally coercive, but at this stage Sartre's idea of good was sufficiently open-ended to exclude his existentialism from the charge of being merely a system of morality in disguise. Only later, as his existentialism became more socially involved, would this change. Meanwhile, unaware that he was merely a pawn in the existential condition of a meteorological private in the French army, Hitler overran Belgium, outflanked the Maginot Line, and invaded France. "They have overstretched their resources and will be unable to defend such a large front," Sartre reassured de Beauvoir. But he must have changed his mind, for within a month carrier pigeon traffic on the entire Eastern Front came to a halt, as Private Sartre willed his and the French army's surrender. Sartre was now able to travel to Germany to study Heidegger in his native land, in a prisoner-of-war camp. Their conditions were no laughing matter. Even so, Sartre continued with his reading program as indefatigably as if he were still at the front line defending his native land. Heidegger held the key. It was he who had taken existentialism the next step beyond Husserl's phenomenology. Heidegger's main work was Sein und Zeit, Being and Time, published in 1927. In this he denies traditional viewpoints such as those of Descartes and Hume. "As an individual I am not, and can never be, a detached observer of the world, one whose utmost certainty is that he thinks, Descartes, or that he has experiences, Hume. No, primarily I am aware of myself as an existent being in the midst of a world. For Heidegger, my utmost certainty is my Dasein, literally being there, more helpfully translated as my being in the world. Heidegger's concept of being is contrasted with knowing through thought or experience, and the abstract concepts that arise from this knowing. Such concepts do not capture the individuality and specificity of my being in the world. This latter, and attaining a deeper awareness of it, is the business of philosophy."